From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We want to start this hour with the thing stopping so many in their tracks, the flu. The season could be among the worst in 15 years, according to federal health officials. It has similarities to the 2009 and 10 swine flu pandemic and is tracking like the 2014-15 flu outbreak, during which 34 million people got sick, about 710,000 were hospitalized, and there were 56,000 flu-related deaths. At least 37 children have died in today's outbreak, but that number could be double because of reporting. And what about Tamiflu? Many doctors say it doesn't work at all. Dr. William Schaffner is an infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Dr. Schaffner, we've got to stop meeting this way.
Good to be with you, but not on this subject, right. I'm afraid.
And it feels like every time there is a bad flu season, we have to kind of remind people how serious it can get. Last week, one in 15 doctor visits in the U.S. were for symptoms of the flu. That's the highest level since the swine flu pandemic of 2009. Now, that was the H1N1 strain, which became a human virus. This year's strain, we thought, was H3N2. So start there. Is there more than one strain?
Well, there's more than one strain, and of course it can, the flu virus can mutate. But the H3N2 strain, which is the dominant strain this year, actually produces more severe disease than did the H1N1 strain back then, particularly among older people, and we're discovering among millennials and also very young children. So it's not age-specific. It's an all-age virus.
Well, but officials seem surprised that while people over 65 have the highest hospitalization rates, and you just explained why, the second highest is people 50 to 64 age range. Why is that?
Well, those people are starting to accumulate underlying illnesses of the heart and the lung. There are smokers there. They have asthma. And so those people are more susceptible to the complications of influenza, pneumonia, for example, and hospitalization.
Well, we should underscore, people 50 to 64 are being hospitalized at triple the rate last season. So there's that caution there. Where are we in the season? Has it peaked?
It's peaked in some parts of the country, but in Middle Tennessee, where I am, we're going gangbusters with flu. So we're in for an influenza season that will go well into February and likely into March. So this is going to be a long and hard influenza season.
Well, California already peaked, but its hospitalization rate was four times higher than during the 2014-15 season. So they got hammered there. Okay, the flu shot. We know we've been told for several days now it's not too late to get one, but it takes 2 weeks for it even to get started.
You know, the flu shot is not perfect. It can't protect against all cases of influenza. But even if you get flu, your illness is going to be milder. You're less likely to get the complications. It is late, but it's not too late. But run, do not walk, to get your influenza vaccine and bring everyone in the family along with you.
Well, when you go this time around, call ahead because some places have run out. And what about Tamiflu? The makers claim it can end a flu case if you have one and prevent one if you've been near someone who has the flu. What's the science behind that?
Actually, Tamiflu can, if taken early, reduce the duration of the illness by a day, maybe half a day. But it can also make it less likely that you'll get the complications of pneumonia and have to be hospitalized. So that's particularly worthwhile for people who have underlying illnesses and those who are over age 65.
Well, but for everybody else, maybe going out to a doctor's office to get a prescription and be seen, you know, maybe it's not as worthwhile for just one day?
Well, call in if you have the flu. And remember, people with underlying illnesses, those are the ones we're most concerned about.
Yeah. You seem more positive about Tamiflu than others that we've read about.
Well, my emphasis is on people with underlying illnesses. And for them, we need all the protection and the prevention that we can get.
Can Tamiflu protect you from getting the flu for if someone around you has had it?
Yes, it can protect you from actually getting the disease. And when influenza is introduced into an assisted living facility or nursing home, the medical director will frequently give Tamiflu to everyone in the facility to prevent spread to other people who reside there.
Well, and again, they are more likely to have the underlying problems. And again, Tamiflu is disappearing, so know that as well. Dr. William Schaffner, infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt University on this flu season. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you, and I hope everyone stays healthy.
Well, could Washington become the first state in the country to pass a tax on carbon pollution? That's the hope of the Democratic Governor Jay Inslee, who now has a Democratic majority in both houses of the state legislature. And Governor Inslee joins us now. Governor, welcome. And you tried this before, but failed. Why do you think this time will be different?
Well, many reasons. Number one, the public really is understanding the critical nature of this existential threat. What used to be a graph on a chart are now our forests burning down and hurricanes and massive precipitation events. So this is something people are now experiencing in their own lives and on their own retinas, and they understand we have to act. Number two, we are learning that we can grow our jobs by having clean energy jobs, and that has been very successful in our state. And number three, we finally have some Democrats who are in the majority in our state legislature. So we have a chance to actually tee it up for discussion. So we feel very excited that this is another opportunity for Washington to do what we do well, which is to innovate and build a high-tech future in clean energy. And we're doing it big time.
How confident are you that all of the Democrats in the legislature will vote with you on this?
Confident enough that I get up every morning working on it. We're doing that right now. We're going through some of the intricacies of the legislation to see if we can get all the votes we need. So I think if you're a confident state, you try big things like this. This is a big thing. It would be the first one in the United States, but it would be consistent with other jurisdictions like British Columbia and California and eight Northeast states to have a price on carbon and use that money effectively to invest in the clean energy economy of the country.
But they've got cap and trade systems. We're talking here about a carbon tax. Why a carbon tax and not cap and trade?
Well, we found it had more support in the legislature. It is a more stable source to finance the research and the deployment to help these clean energy jobs develop. Our cap and trade system is a little more volatile, depends on the supply and demand. So it does have some advantages of predictability and stability. But it has the really big advantage is we got a shot of passing it in the legislature. This is what our state needs, and it's a good way to get it.
Do you think it's going to make enough of a difference, though, if a state like Washington implements a carbon tax, if in the other Washington, in Washington, D.C., you have a president who is, some would say, a climate change skeptic, some might say a climate denier?
Well, I have other choice language about the president that I could use, but he's certainly no help on this score. But no, this does not stop us. We've got to understand Donald Trump cannot stop my state from fighting climate change. He cannot stop us from adopting a renewable portfolio standard. He cannot stop us from developing a carbon tax. We are masters of our own destiny, and we're not alone. We have 14 other states and one territory. We have a group called the United States Climate Alliance, and all of these states are allied in committing to meet our international targets for CO2 reduction. But we do need to move forward, and we are. So, no one has followed Donald Trump off the edge of the cliff here. He's a one-man parade. There hasn't been a single mayor or governor or president or prime minister in the entire country, in the entire world who has followed him over the flat earth society cliff. And so we're moving forward in our states, and we're proud of our efforts.
What's your response to people who say that a carbon tax is actually going to hurt the poor because they'll pay more for things that they need?
Well, we are sensitive to that, and that why in our plan we're providing some measures to recycle some of this funds to low-income folks for energy costs. And if you think about these things and do this in a sensitive, thoughtful manner, you both grow jobs, you help neighbors, you reduce pollution, you reduce the respiratory problems our kids are suffering, and you grow your economy. And you look at British Columbia, they have a carbon tax, but they have the best economy in Canada. California is moving forward. Eight Northeast states have had a price on carbon from their utilities for years, and their economies are very robust. This is a situation where if we make decisions based on evidence and just 1 ounce of a can-do spirit, this country's going to do what it's always done, which is to grow and lead the world. And it's time to do that again, Trump or no Trump.
One more thing I want to ask you about, Governor. You are joining us from, obviously, Washington State, home to Amazon, which is in the midst of its much publicized nationwide hunt for a new city to host its second headquarters. And one of the storylines that has emerged is that people in Seattle are saying, you people don't want this second Amazon headquarters. It's driven up prices here. It's made things unaffordable. What do you think, as the governor of the state that is home to Amazon? Does it make sense for other places to get the second headquarters, or would you say don't bother?
Well, I think the response, where you have cities all over the country or the continent vying for this position, indicate what people think, which is generally having job creation to help your economy grow is a positive thing, and that's what's happened in our community. There's spinoff effects, and it's like everything else. There's a yin and a yang, but we'll take the jobs.
That's Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington. Governor, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
How often do you use physics in order to survive? Well, probably more than you think if we humans are like the rest of the species on Earth. The book Furry Logic, The Physics of Animal Life, takes a look at some incredible examples of how animals, large and small, use physics in their everyday lives. The book comes out in paperback this week. Furry Logic is written by Mateen Durrani, editor of Physics World, and Liz Callagher, a science and environment reporter. I spoke with them last March, and Callagher told me that the book was written for people who may not know much about physics.
Yes, that's right. We tried to make it accessible for everybody. There's so many stories in there. You've got the stories of the animals, the stories of the researchers looking at the animals, and then you've got the story of the physics as well. So we really had fun weaving all those stories together.
Well, I want to get through a lot of examples here because they're so interesting what some of these animals do. Starting with the principle of heat and the red-sided garter snake, which go into burrows for the winter, and then come spring, they come out all at once, and some of the males actually become what you call she-males. Explain.
If you go to Manitoba in Canada, there are some snake pits where thousands of snakes live underground during the winter. They hibernate there because it's so cold that they bunker down for the winter. Come the spring, they come out and there are these giant balls of snakes on the ground, really cold. And it turns out that this was a huge mystery for many, many years, and people really didn't know what these snakes were doing, writhing around above the surface. And what they're trying to do is the female snakes that come out, they disappear as fast as they can. And the males that come out, they're trying to steal heat from the other snakes. So they get jumped on by all these other snakes and steal the heat and warm up. And it's called kleptothermy.
Hmm. And why do they have to pretend to be females in order to do that?
Ah, well, that's the thing. What they do is they coat themselves with sex chemicals, pheromones. So it fools the other snakes into thinking they're women and they jump on top.
There's another issue that involves heat or infrared radiation. It involves the Pacific rattlesnake, which has sensing pits that can detect infrared radiation, so it can sense prey like squirrels from the heat that the squirrel produces. But the squirrels have come up with their own defense. Explain.
Well, that's right. Snakes and squirrels in California have been fighting for millions of years. But the squirrels are really clever. What they do is they know, or they've learnt that the snakes can detect infrared radiation. So that's the blood in their tails gives off this signal. And so what the squirrels do is they wave their bushy tails in the air, pump lots of blood into it, and that gives off a lot of infrared radiation. And the snakes are fooled and confused and then back off because they see this very unusual signal, not just a tail standing up, but it's giving off this very unusual infrared radiation, a sort of heat map on the tail. And we're not quite sure what the snakes think, but we reckon that they're confused, and so they back off from the squirrel.
Well, Liz, do we know why they do these things? Have they figured out that physics are important?
That's a really interesting question. There's a book about folk physics, and it seems that even humans who don't know physics formally use physics near enough in that we know if we drop something, we can work out that it will go in a kind of a parabola to the floor, and that's good enough. So these animals, they don't know physics in an intellectual way, but they know enough to use it. in the same way that, say, a skateboarder would use physics as they fly through the air and be able to land.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that you point out is something that I'm sure everyone who's listening has seen, but maybe didn't realize that it involves physics, which is when a dog gets out of the water and shakes that water off.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, and no dog's stupid enough to let evaporation take its course, which is, you know, so what a dog does, it shakes itself dry by rotating its backbone back and forth. And people have calculated how much energy it saves by doing it rather than letting the water disappear through evaporation. And it saves, I think, about a 500th of the energy. And in fact, the interesting thing is the rules that the dog follows to shake itself dry are followed by all hairy animals. And there's some fantastic studies of everything from little rats all the way up to big bears. They all follow this same shaking rule.
And is that innate?
I guess it is. I think that's probably something that they don't learn from their parents, although I guess they could learn it by copying their parents. But I would guess that it's instinctive.
We're speaking with Liz Callagher and Mateen Durrani. Their new book is called Furry Logic, The Physics of Animal Life. And let's get to another example here. The harlequin mantis shrimp, which is very small, but can break open a crab with its clubs because of the way that it hits that crab. Can you tell us about that one?
Sure. Yeah. These little shrimp are amazing. They're not only multicolored and absolutely beautiful looking, but they have some of the fastest accelerations in nature. So they, to get at the crab meat that they want to eat, they shoot out their elbows on their second pair of, let's call them legs, and they shoot them out so fast that the amount of force they get through Newton's second law, that's related to the acceleration. And because their muscles, they can't build up that acceleration just by themselves. They hold their muscles shut and squeeze them very slowly and then release a latch that lets their leg unfold incredibly fast. And that creates enough force to smash through the crab.
Wow.
And their problems aren't over quite then, because after they've hit a few crabs for a few meals, they could damage themselves, but they actually then have a really clever structure to their shell to protect their own shell from getting cracked.
Huh. Amazing. And another one that people probably have seen before but maybe didn't realize what was going on is when a cat drinks water. It's not actually scooping that water up and putting it into its mouth, is it?
No. The guy who first came studied in depth how cats drink was a guy at a Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Roman Stocker, and he was at home one morning watching his cat, Cutter, having over breakfast. He was watching his cat drink, and it suddenly occurred to him, you know, how on earth does this cat drink? So, like all good scientists, he went back to his lab, took some high-speed video equipment back home, and did some slow-motion footage of the cat drinking. And that's right, cat will layer its tongue on the surface of the liquid. It doesn't enter the liquid. And then it lifts the tip of the tongue up very slowly, and it forms a column of liquid that it then snaps into its mouth and captures a little bit of liquid every time. And it repeats that several times every second, so it's quite a quick process.
So you couldn't see it with your naked eye if you tried to watch?
No, it's you really have to have these high-speed cameras, and then if you slow down the footage, you can watch it. The fantastic thing is this guy did a really good research paper that was on the cover of the journal Science, which is one of the top journals. So out of all the bits of work he did, he said to me that, you know, this one had more kudos, had more recognition than anything he's ever done. So, you know, studying animals can really be good for your career if you're a scientist.
Hmm. Well, there's one more that I really want to get to because it's so interesting, which is how a gecko is able to walk across the ceiling.
Sure. Yeah. Geckos are amazing. They use a really quite complicated form of physics called van der Waals forces, which are these tiny little forces that you get between molecules if you get the molecules really, really close up. So by putting its feet very close to the ceiling, and it has fleshy folds on its feet and lots of hairs. So by having all these hairs, it gets a huge surface area. And adding up all the very small forces over a lot of area gives the gecko enough force in total that it can walk upside down on the ceiling. And if it falls off, it can actually hold its whole body weight with just one foot and possibly even one toe.
So why haven't we been able to figure out a way to make shoes like that for humans?
Good question. Some people are actually trying. There's a material called geck skin, which copies the folds on the feet. And they did manage to get a guy to climb up a glass wall using a pair of gloves made of this material. So that's pretty clever.
That's going to be a hot Christmas gift when that one comes to fruition. So what was the purpose of all of this? I mean, these are all really interesting facts, but why did you want to point out how much animals use physics?
I think it partly is my job as editor of Physics World, and Liz works with me at IP Publishing, also as a science journalist. You know, we're always on the lookout for interesting ways to explain what scientists get up to. And I think a lot of people get quite scared by science for whatever reason or don't find it interesting. But, you know, we always think people love animals. And what a cool way of kind of talking about some exciting physics topics using the guise of animals. And everyone loves cats. Everyone loves dogs. There are fish in the book. There are bees and all sorts of animals. So using that as a method of just talking about some of the interesting physics that, you know, we don't go, some of it's not terribly difficult. It's fairly straightforward, but, you know, fun as well.
If I can just add to that, it's often at some of the interfaces between different types of science where some of the most interesting stuff happens. So finding out about animals and physics can bring us whole new areas.
And what about us as humans? I mean, did you, as you looked through what other animals are doing, did you find out anything interesting about what we do with physics in our own daily lives?
One of the things that really interested me was when researchers are looking at animal senses, when animals can sense things that we can't. So there were researchers looking at how turtles use magnetism to navigate, and another researcher looking at how bees use electric fields. And in both cases, we can't probably sense those fields. So that's something that I found fascinating.
So interesting. Liz Callagher and Mateen Durrani, authors of the book Furry Logic, The Physics of Animal Life. I spoke with them last March when the book was first published. It is out in paperback this week.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punterful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And there was a day of mourning in Kabul, Afghanistan today after Saturday's massacre in which the Taliban blew up an ambulance packed with explosives, killing more than 100. But the mourning today was interrupted by another attack by ISIS on a military academy, 11 Afghan army guards killed. The BBC's Zia Shahriar is in Kabul. So Zia, an ISIS attack today, a Taliban attack Saturday, the Taliban attacked that hotel a week ago, ISIS attacked the Save the Children headquarters. Are they competing?
Robin, this is interesting to see that Taliban and ISIS are leading attacks in different cities, Kabul and Jalalabad. And there are now suspicions that these attacks are probably coordinated between the two groups. Obviously, there is no evidence that they are coordinating these attacks. But in the past, the Afghan government and many other military analysts have said that there is coordination between Taliban and ISIS. It's a very difficult time for Afghanistan.
Well, but I want to be clear, because we'd heard in the past that, you know, ISIS and the Taliban were fighting each other. Are you saying that they might even be sharing these attacks, that it might not be the Taliban, but the Taliban gets to claim it? In other words, have they merged?
Well, the story of ISIS in Afghanistan is a bit complicated. We've had reports of fighting between Taliban and ISIS. But ISIS in Afghanistan is mostly constituted of dissatisfied Taliban groups. So there are coordinations as well, possibly between them sometimes. The Afghan government increasingly is saying that most of the attacks claimed by ISIS is done by Haqqani Network, which is a splinter group of the Taliban, and it's mostly based in Pakistan, supported by Pakistan.
Well, Pakistan did come out today and condemn the attack, but as you alluded to, there are concerns. But today's attack on this military academy on an army base, the attack by ISIS today, but it was attacked last October by the Taliban, and 15 were killed then. It also was the scene in 2014 where the highest-ranking U.S. military officer to be lost in either the Afghan or Iraqi wars was killed. This was Army Major General Harold Green. He was shot and killed by an Afghan soldier. Has this particular base become symbolic of something?
This base and the military academy beside it is probably the most important military base for Afghan security forces, as well as some foreign trainers there. The military academy is training Afghan soldiers, and there are British and American trainers who are training these soldiers and officers. So the Taliban and probably ISIS now are targeting this academy to symbolically say that they are attacking absolutely a military target, and where Afghans are being trained to fight the Taliban and ISIS. So, yeah, that is definitely a very important military target for them.
Just very briefly, how are residents feeling? They've got to be numb.
Residents are completely shocked and overwhelmed. Hospitals are full of injured people from the attacks in the last few days. People are mourning, and people are absolutely angry with the government, with the security officials, and they are asking for stricter measures.
Yeah. The BBC's Zia Zaharyar in Kabul. Zia, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. Have a nice day.
And it has been noted that non-white characters are underrepresented on TV and in the movies. For instance, one study out of the University of Southern California shows that out of nearly 4,000 speaking roles in the 100 top-grossing movies of 2014, fewer than 5% were played by Hispanic characters, even though they make up 16% of the population. But TV is taking a stab at representation with remakes of classic shows recast with Hispanic characters and storylines. NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching. And Eric, I'm trying to think, how unusual is it to create a remake fundamentally different from the original?
TV is sort of embroiled in kind of remake fever right now. Will and Grace and Roseanne are being redone, and they're doing them mostly with the original cast, and they're kind of doing it the way the show was done when it was originally on. But MacGyver has been redone on CBS with a totally new cast, younger people. And SWAT has been redone for CBS, and it stars a black man in the lead role, whereas in the original, most of the characters were white. Yeah. So you do see some creators saying, maybe we'll think about having more diversity among the characters and trying to, you know, find new storylines that way.
Well, let's take a listen to one show. Netflix has its second season of One Day at a Time. Remind us what the original was like, and then we'll listen to a little of the new one.
So the original show was pioneering because it featured a divorced woman raising her daughters on her own. And so the new version of One Day at a Time uses kind of the same situation. It's a mom on her own. The husband is overseas serving in the military, and she also has a grandmother, but the family is of Cuban heritage. There's a great scene where Rita Moreno talks as her character, the grandmother of this family, about what it felt like when she was called a spick by someone when she was younger. So let's listen to that clip.
When it is being yelled at you as you are walking home from a school, a teenage girl who can barely speak the language, you are thinking first, it is a catcall because of my perfect legs. But then your friend Valentina tells you, no, in fact, it is a hate word.
Obviously, very different characters, but what are we seeing? I mean, does it feel like One Day at a Time?
In some ways it does. The set of the apartment where most of these situations take place is set up kind of the way the original set was on the show. And they talk about issues directly in the same way that Norman Lear's classic sitcoms always did. Of course, it's very different because this is a Cuban American family, and they are very proud of their heritage, and they often have situations come up. Or in the case of the episode that this speech came from, the young son in the family was called a derogatory name at school, and he got in a fight, and that got them talking about how they have to face racism every day because of their heritage.
Right. Well, the theme song was also updated. Let's listen. So, Eric Deggans, how are people reacting?
Critics really liked the show and made a lot of people's best of lists, even though the first season dropped more than a year ago on Netflix. I was a little more measured. I do think sometimes the scenes are kind of clunky, but I love the spirit of the show. And there's so little representation of Latino and Hispanic characters on big, high-profile TV shows that I really welcome this effort, and it really needs to spread.
Yeah. Well, there's a little more. Last week, the cable channel Freeform announced it's going to remake Party of Five. This is the really popular show about five children. Their parents had been killed. The older kids raised the younger ones. And so how's that being adapted?
So what we've learned is that this is about a family of kids that have to figure out how to stay together when the parents are deported. Mm. And what I've heard is that the oldest sibling is actually going to be a DACA recipient and might be at risk of being deported as well. And then the younger kids will all be American citizens. And in fact, the writers will have to keep a sharp eye on what's happening now with the politics so that it feels realistic. It's a way of humanizing a lot of these policy discussions and political fights that we're having right now on the front page of every newspaper.
So we're talking about having more Hispanic representation on TV, and you've written a terrific article that we'll post at hereandnow.org. You say, first of all, you know, when it comes to films and TV shows, Hollywood isn't paying the price. Hispanics go to movies and watch television in, you know, huge numbers. They're not turned away even when they're not represented. But why else don't Hispanic viewers, as you put it, respond as strongly to Hispanic characters and demand them as maybe black viewers do to shows featuring black characters?
There's so many different nationalities and cultures inside the Hispanic designation that we have in America. So, for example, when the George Lopez show was on ABC, you know, George Lopez is Mexican. The fictional family was Mexican. So if you're Cuban or if you're Puerto Rican or if you're from Venezuela, you may not feel that that show really represents your culture. Now, Spanish language television has a way of sort of uniting across cultures and nationalities through language. But English language shows aren't able to do that. But the shows are more interesting when they're more diverse. Why not do more of that to make the shows better?
That's Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic. Eric, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, over the past few decades, scientists across the country have been trying to bring back an animal called a fisher, a member of the weasel family. A few years ago, one group released 70 of the animals in Washington State's Cascade Mountains. Ken Christensen of EarthFix tagged along as scientists tried to figure out if it worked.
Jeff Lewis is ascending into the foothills of the Cascade Mountain Range.
Do you want to head for 49-ish, you said?
Yeah, let's head for Mount St. Helens here in the blast zone.
He and his pilot are searching for a rare animal in the forest below.
So if you look real close, you see her running through the trees right there? I'm joking.
So they won't be seeing any fishers from this high up, but after Lewis turns a few knobs on a receiver, eventually he can hear them. That faint beep is the sound of a tracking device.
Guess what? That's 88. Son of a gun.
Cross back across the road.
Woohoo!
It's a long-awaited reunion, because 2 years ago, Lewis put them here. He's a biologist for the state's Department of Fish and Wildlife, where he's spent decades studying the fisher.
When you say fisher, and everybody goes, kingfisher? Or are you talking about somebody with a fishing rod, or what are you talking about? They're a beautiful, charismatic, somewhat chunky weasel.
People in the early 1900s thought their fur was beautiful. The fisher disappeared across the Pacific Northwest, and much of the country, because of unregulated fur trapping. So in 2015, Lewis and a group of scientists began bringing them back here. They drove the animals south from Canada, equipped them with tracking devices, and set them loose on unfamiliar terrain. Now, they need to find out whether the animals are reproducing.
We're closer than ever.
That's Tara Chestnut. She's an ecologist at Mount Rainier National Park.
So we're about 80 yards from the potential den site that we are looking for.
They're following the signal for a fisher named Lily. Chestnut says their goal is to track Lily to a specific tree and set up motion-sensored cameras. It's one of the few ways to document whether she's raising young.
Hey, guys, I got her super close right there, over there. So she's not far away.
As they get closer, they look for telltale signs, like scratch marks on bark, fur snagged on branches, and other clues.
They love taking poops on logs.
Wow. Lots of hair in this one. Yeah. Somebody definitely spent a lot of time in this tree.
Probably at the top of the tree, there's a cavity big enough to house a female fisher and her young. They set up the cameras. Then, 1 month later, back at the office, they check the images. The first one, two glowing eyes in the night.
Maybe it's a fisher. Maybe it's a baby black bear. Maybe it's a raccoon. It's a black-brown blob.
A few images later, the brown blob reveals itself. A female fisher running down the side of the tree with a smaller fisher in its mouth.
Oh, baby. Yes, that's the one. See, there's
it's the first bit of hard evidence suggesting that fishers could survive here once again. Next year, this team will bring another 80 fishers to Washington's North Cascades, where they hope they'll have plenty of company. For Here and Now, I'm Ken Christensen in Olympia, Washington.
And Ken's story comes to us from EarthFix, a regional reporting effort among public radio stations in the Northwest. There was a moment in last night's Grammy Awards that is not going over well with the Trump administration. It featured a number of celebrities reading excerpts from the book Fire and Fury inside the Trump White House, including a cameo from Hillary Clinton.
He had a longtime fear of being poisoned. One reason why he liked to eat at McDonald's. Nobody knew he was coming, and the food was safely pre-made.
That sound courtesy of CBS and the Recording Academy. As you can hear, the audience liked it, but UN Ambassador Nikki Haley didn't, tweeting afterwards that the segment killed the Grammys for her and don't ruin great music with trash. Well, here to look at that and other moments from the Grammys is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. He's with us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And a lot of politics in that ceremony last night.
Yeah, a lot of politics. It's really remarkable. I mean, partisan politics is everywhere now. You can't get it out of acting awards. You can't get it out of music awards. And I think it just goes to show very simply, and this is, you know, not breaking any new news, that Donald Trump has essentially occupied the most valuable real estate in America. That is the real estate of all of our brains. It is impossible for anybody in a public position to go several minutes without mentioning something in or related to politics. And that's exactly what we saw last night, that a show that is often quasi-political, but rarely explicitly so, was very much taking the Trump administration head-on, even reading a book that we all know is deeply critical of the president and his abilities in the office.
And the president was also referenced during a performance by U2. The band performed Get Out of Your Own Way from a barge in front of the Statue of Liberty. And at one point, Bono shouted this through a megaphone. You can't really hear it there, but he said, blessed are the bleep countries, for they gave us the American dream. Now, I'm not going to say that word right now. People have heard it. They know what it is. But the Grammys also bleeped it out, and there's some criticism about that.
Right, because the broadcast network bleeped a curse word that the president said, that TV reporters repeated over and over and over. It's a news story. And so, yeah, it's a little bit weird that journalists can say the word, which I will not say, to criticize the president, but musicians can't say the same word to criticize the president. That typically you would put, you know, give a little bit more poetic leeway for art to protest than any, you know, typical reporter or analyst. So, yeah. It's just impossible to escape the issue right. of politics, even at in the outro of a U2 song, and the issue of what can people hear and not hear, that even that decision itself is so hyperpolitical, is just so telling of our time.
By the way, NPR made a decision early on to use that word on the day it was being reported first, and then to kind of use it sparingly since then. Now, when you look at the ratings for last night, we're already getting a report from Variety that there were 17.6 million viewers for the Grammys, which was down sharply. What do you make of that?
Yeah, the Grammys audience declined by nearly 10 million viewers, or about 30%. That's a remarkable decline. You know, there's a lot of potential reasons why. You know, maybe last year there was a lot of interest to see if Beyonce was going to win. Adele ended up taking the award for Best Album, if I recall, for an album that sold tremendously. This year, you know, the front runners, even though Bruno Mars came away with Best Recording, Best Album, Best Song, a lot of people, you know, sort of thought that Kendrick Lamar or Jay-Z, two rappers, could come away with the award. Those albums, I don't think they sold as well as Beyonce plus Adele, so maybe there was a little bit less interest in the content itself. But behind the nitty-gritty of, you know, substance versus substance over the years, the big story here is that you do have structural decline in paid TV viewership and in cable television penetration. And so that also played a role as well.
Alessia Cara won Best New Artist last night. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
There are some incredible artists out there that are making incredible music that deserve to be acknowledged, that don't always get acknowledged because of popularity contests or numbers games. And that's kind of unfortunate. So I just wanted to encourage everyone to support real music and real artists, because everyone deserves the same shot.
Derek, what's she getting at there? Are the Grammys basically a popularity contest?
I have not had a chance to interview Alessia Cara this morning. I don't know exactly what she's getting at. But, you know, the thing about the Grammys, though, especially when you compare them with something like the Oscars, is that just because there's so much music out there, there has to be some sort of sorting function. And often that sorting function, when it comes to the nominees, is popularity. So you don't have a lot of artists up for several awards that have small followings. The people who get several awards tend to be, you know, Bruno Mars, Kendrick Lamar, among the most famous hip-hop and rap stars out there. The Oscars, by comparison, it's a situation where it's relatively common, actually, for a small movie to come away with a bunch of nominations or awards, something like Three Billboards or Lady Bird. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that the Grammy Awards are more of a popularity contest than other award shows, I do think she's correct there, yes.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. And Derek, we're just a few days out from the Super Bowl. Do you expect the ratings to be down for that as well?
I do, yeah. I do expect them to be down. I'll go on record by saying I'll bet they'll be 8% down from last year.
8%. All right,
yes.
Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.